From Russia with Love by Ian Fleming. Copyright 1957 by Glidrose Productions Limited. This unabridged recording of the reading of From Russia with Love was published by arrangement with Ian Fleming Glidrose Publications Limited and was produced in 2000 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book is read by Robert Whitfield. This book is 201 pages long. From Russia with Love by Ian Fleming. The following material appears on the book's back cover. Readable, highly polished, irresistible. The Sunday Times. Mr. Fleming is in a class by himself. Immense detail, elaborate settings, and continually mounting tension, flavoured with sex, brutality, and sudden death. Anthony Price. SMERSH is the Soviet organ of vengeance, of interrogation, torture, and death. James Bond is dedicated to the destruction of its agents wherever he finds them. Then the cold eye of SMERSH focuses on James Bond, and far away in Moscow a trap is laid for him, a death trap, with an enticing lure. Author's note. Not that it matters, but a great deal of the background to this story is accurate. SMERSH, a contraction of Smertspionam, death to spies, exists and remains today the most secret department of the Soviet government. At the beginning of 1956, when this book was written, the strength of SMERSH at home and abroad was about 40,000, and General Grubotsa-Boyshikov was its chief. My description of his appearance is correct. Today the headquarters of SMERSH are where, in Chapter 4, I have placed them, at No. 13, Sretenka Ulitsa, Moscow. The conference room is faithfully described, and the intelligence chiefs who meet round the table are real officials, who are frequently summoned to that room for purposes similar to those I have recounted. I.F. Part 1. The Plan. Chapter 1. Roseland. The naked man who lay splayed out on his face beside the swimming pool might have been dead. He might have been drowned and fished out of the pool and laid out on the grass to dry while the police or the next of kin were summoned. Even the little pile of objects in the grass beside his head might have been his personal effects, meticulously assembled in full view so that no one should think that something had been stolen by his rescuers. To judge by the glittering pile, this had been, or was, a rich man. It contained the typical membership badges of the rich man's club, a money clip made of a Mexican $50 piece and holding a substantial wad of banknotes, a well-used gold Dunhill lighter, an oval gold cigarette case with the wavy ridges and discreet turquoise button that means Fabergé, and the sort of novel a rich man pulls out of the bookcase to take into the garden, The Little Nugget, an old P.G. Woodhouse. There was also a bulky gold wristwatch on a well-used brown crocodile strap. It was a Girard Perregaux model, designed for people who like gadgets, and it had a sweep second hand and two little windows in the face to tell the day of the month, and the phase of the moon. The story it now told was 2:30 on June the 10th, with the moon three-quarters full. A blue and green dragonfly flashed out from among the rose bushes at the end of the garden and hovered in mid-air a few inches above the base of the man's spine. It had been attracted by the golden shimmer of the June sunshine on the ridge of fine blonde hairs above the coccyx. A puff of breeze came off the sea. The tiny field of hairs bent gently. The dragonfly darted nervously sideways and hung above the man's left shoulder, looking down. The young grass below the man's open mouth stirred. A large drop of sweat rolled down the side of the fleshy nose and dropped, glittering, into the grass. That was enough. The dragonfly flashed away through the roses and over the jagged glass on top of the high garden wall. It might be good food, but it moved. The garden in which the man lay was about an acre of well-kept lawn, surrounded on three sides by thickly banked rose bushes from which came the steady murmur of bees. Behind the drowsy noise of the bees, the sea boomed softly at the bottom of the cliff at the end of the garden. There was no view of the sea from the garden, no view of anything except of the sky and the clouds above the 12-foot wall. In fact, you could only see out of the property from the two upstairs bedrooms of the villa that formed the fourth side of this very private enclosure. From them you could see a great expanse of blue water in front of you, and on either side the upper windows of neighbouring villas and the tops of the trees in their gardens, Mediterranean-type evergreen oaks, stone pines, casuarinas, and an occasional palm tree. The villa was modern, a squat, elongated box without ornament. On the garden side, the flat pink-washed façade was pierced by four iron-framed windows and by a central glass door leading onto a small square of pale green glazed tiles. The tiles merged into the lawn. The other side of the villa, standing back a few yards from a dusty road, was almost identical. But on this side the four windows were barred, and the central door was of oak. The villa had two medium-sized bedrooms on the upper floor, and on the ground floor a sitting room and a kitchen, part of which was walled off into a lavatory. There was no bathroom. The drowsy, luxurious silence of early afternoon was broken by the sound of a car coming down the road. It stopped in front of the villa. There was the tinny clang of a car door being slammed, and the car drove on. The doorbell rang twice. The naked man beside the swimming pool did not move, but at the noise of the bell and of the departing car, his eyes had for an instant opened very wide. It was as if the eyelids had pricked up like an animal's ears. The man immediately remembered where he was, and the day of the week, and the time of the day. The noises were identified. The eyelids, with their fringe of short, sandy eyelashes, drooped drowsily back over the very pale, blue, opaque, inward-looking eyes. The small, cruel lips opened in a wide, jaw-breaking yawn, which brought saliva into the mouth. The man spat the saliva into the grass and waited. A young woman carrying a small string bag and dressed in a white cotton shirt and a short, unalluring blue skirt came through the glass door and strode mannishly across the glazed tiles and the stretch of lawn towards the naked man. A few yards away from him, she dropped her string bag on the grass and sat down and took off her cheap and rather dusty shoes. Then she stood up and unbuttoned her shirt and took it off and put it, neatly folded, beside the string bag. The girl had nothing on under the shirt. Her skin was pleasantly sunburned, and her shoulders and fine breasts shone with health. When she bent her arms to undo the side buttons of her skirt, small tufts of fair hair showed in her armpits. The impression of a healthy animal peasant girl was heightened by the chunky hips in faded blue stockinette bathing trunks and the thick short thighs and legs that were revealed when she had stripped. The girl put the skirt neatly beside her shirt, opened the string bag, took out an old soda-water bottle containing some heavy, colourless liquid, and went over to the man and knelt on the grass beside him. She poured some of the liquid, a light olive oil, scented, as was everything in that part of the world, with roses, between his shoulder blades, and after flexing her fingers like a pianist, began massaging the sternomastoid and the trapezius muscles at the back of the man's neck. It was hard work. The man was immensely strong, and the bulging muscles at the base of the neck hardly yielded to the girl's thumbs, even when the downward weight of her shoulders was behind them. By the time she was finished with the man, she would be soaked in perspiration and so utterly exhausted that she would fall into the swimming pool and then lie down in the shade and sleep until the car came for her. But that wasn't what she minded, as her hands worked automatically on across the man's back. It was her instinctive horror for the finest body she had ever seen. None of this horror showed in the flat, impassive face of the masseuse, and the upward slanting black eyes under the fringe of short, coarse black hair were as empty as oil slicks. But inside her the animal whimpered and cringed, and her pulse rate, if it had occurred to her to take it, would have been high. Once again, as so often over the past 2 years, she wondered why she loathed this splendid body, and once again she vaguely tried to analyze her revulsion. Perhaps this time she would get rid of feelings which she felt guiltily certain were much more unprofessional than the sexual desire some of her patients awoke in her. To take the small things first, his hair. She looked down at the round, smallish head on the sinewy neck. It was covered with tight red-gold curls that should have reminded her pleasantly of the formalized hair in the pictures she had seen of classical statues. But the curls were somehow too tight, too thickly pressed against each other and against the skull. They set her teeth on edge, like fingernails against pile carpet. And the golden curls came down so low into the back of the neck, almost, she thought in professional terms, to the fifth cervical vertebra. And there they stopped abruptly, in a straight line of small, stiff, golden hairs. The girl paused to give her hands a rest and sat back on her haunches. The beautiful upper half of her body was already shining with sweat. She wiped the back of her forearm across her forehead and reached for the bottle of oil. She poured about a tablespoonful onto the small, furry plateau at the base of the man's spine, flexed her fingers, and bent forward again. This embryo tail of golden down above the cleft of the buttocks. In a lover it would have been gay, exciting, but on this man it was somehow bestial. No, reptilian. But snakes had no hair. Well, she couldn't help that. It seemed reptilian to her. She shifted her hands on down to the two mounds of the gluteal muscles. Now was the time when many of her patients, particularly the young ones on the football team, would start joking with her. Then, if she was not very careful, the suggestions would come. Sometimes she could silence these by digging sharply down towards the sciatic nerve. At other times, and particularly if she found the man attractive, there would be giggling arguments, a brief wrestling match, and a quick, delicious surrender. With this man it was different. Almost uncannily different. From the very first he had been like a lump of inanimate meat. In 2 years he had never said a word to her. When she had done his back and it was time for him to turn over, neither his eyes nor his body had once shown the smallest interest in her. When she tapped his shoulder, he would just roll over and gaze at the sky through half-closed lids, and occasionally let out one of the long, shuddering yawns that were the only sign that he had human reactions at all. The girl shifted her position and slowly worked down the right leg towards the Achilles tendon. When she came to it, she looked back up the fine body. Was her revulsion only physical? Was it the reddish colour of the sunburn on the naturally milk-white skin, the sort of roast meat look? Was it the texture of the skin itself, the deep, widely spaced pores in the satiny surface, the thickly scattered orange freckles on the shoulders, or was it the sexuality of the man, the indifference of these splendid, insolently bulging muscles? Or was it spiritual, an animal instinct telling her that inside this wonderful body there was an evil person? The masseuse got to her feet and stood, twisting her head slowly from side to side and flexing her shoulders. She stretched her arms out sideways and then upwards and held them for a moment to get the blood down out of them. She went to her string bag and took out a hand towel and wiped the perspiration off her face and body. When she turned back to the man, he had already rolled over and now lay, his head resting on one open hand, gazing blankly at the sky. The disengaged arm was flung out on the grass, waiting for her. She walked over and knelt on the grass behind his head. She rubbed some oil into her palms, picked up the limp, half-open hand, and started kneading the short, thick fingers. The girl glanced nervously sideways at the red-brown face below the crown of tight golden curls. Superficially it was all right, handsome in a butcher's boyish way, with its full pink cheeks, upturned nose, and rounded chin. But, looked at closer, there was something cruel about the thin-lipped, rather pursed mouth, a pigginess about the wide nostrils in the upturned nose, and the blankness that veiled the very pale blue eyes communicated itself over the whole face and made it look drowned and morgue-like. It was, she reflected, as if someone had taken a china doll and painted its face to frighten. The masseuse worked up the arm to the huge biceps. Where had the man got these fantastic muscles from? Was he a boxer? What did he do with his formidable body? Rumour said this was a police villa. The two men-servants were obviously guards of some sort, although they did the cooking and the housework. Regularly every month the man went away for a few days, and she would be told not to come. And from time to time she would be told to stay away for a week, or 2 weeks, or a month. Once, after one of these absences, the man's neck and the upper part of his body had been a mass of bruises. On another occasion, the red corner of a half-healed wound had shown under a foot of surgical plaster down the ribs over his heart. She had never dared to ask about him at the hospital or in the town. When she had first been sent to the house, one of the men servants had told her that if she spoke about what she saw, she would go to prison. Back at the hospital, the chief superintendent, who had never recognized her existence before, had sent for her and had said the same thing. She would go to prison. The girl's strong fingers gouged nervously into the big deltoid muscle on the point of the shoulder. She had always known it was a matter of state security. Perhaps that was what revolted her about this splendid body. Perhaps it was just fear of the organization that had the body in custody. She squeezed her eyes shut at the thought of who he might be, of what he could order to be done to her. Quickly she opened them again. He might have noticed. But the eyes gazed blankly up at the sky. Now she reached for the oil to do the face. The girl's thumbs had scarcely pressed into the sockets of the man's closed eyes when the telephone in the house started ringing. The sound reached impatiently out into the quiet garden. At once the man was up on one knee like a runner waiting for the gun, but he didn't move forward. The ringing stopped. There was the mutter of a voice. The girl could not hear what it was saying, but it sounded humble, noting instructions. The voice stopped, and one of the men servants showed briefly at the door, made a gesture of summons, and went back into the house. Halfway through the gesture, the naked man was already running. She watched the brown back flash through the open glass door. Better not let him find her there when he came out again, doing nothing, perhaps listening. She got to her feet, took 2 steps to the concrete edge of the pool, and dived gracefully in. Although it would have explained her instincts about the man whose body she massaged, it was as well for the girl's peace of mind that she did not know who he was. His real name was Donovan Grant, or Red Grant. But for the past 10 years it had been Krasnogranitsky, with the code name of Granite. He was the chief executioner of SMERSH, the murder apparat of the MGB, and at this moment he was receiving his instructions on the MGB direct line with Moscow. Chapter 2. The Slaughterer. Grant put the telephone softly back on its cradle and sat looking at it. The bullet-headed guard standing over him said,
"You had better start moving."
"Did they give you any idea of the task?"
Grant spoke Russian excellently, but with a thick accent. He could have passed for a national of any of the Soviet Baltic provinces. The voice was high and flat, as if it was reading something dull from a book.
"No, only that you are wanted in Moscow. The plane is on its way. It will be here in about an hour. Half an hour for refueling, and then 3 or 4 hours, depending on whether you come down at Kharkov. You will be in Moscow by midnight. You had better pack. I will order the car."
Grant got nervously to his feet.
"Yes, you are right. But they didn't even say if it was an operation. One likes to know. It was a secure line. They could have given a hint. They generally do."
"This time they didn't."
Grant walked slowly out through the glass door onto the lawn. If he noticed the girl sitting on the far edge of the pool, he made no sign. He bent and picked up his book and the golden trophies of his profession, and walked back into the house and up the few stairs to his bedroom. The room was bleak and furnished only with an iron bedstead from which the rumpled sheets hung down on one side to the floor, a cane chair, an unpainted clothes cupboard, and a cheap washstand with a tin basin. The floor was strewn with English and American magazines. Garish paperbacks and hardcover thrillers were stacked against the wall below the window. Grant bent down and pulled a battered Italian fiber suitcase from under the bed. He packed into it a selection of well-laundered, cheap, respectable clothes from the cupboard. Then he washed his body hurriedly with cold water and the inevitably rose-scented soap, and dried himself on one of the sheets from the bed. There was the noise of a car outside. Grant hastily dressed in clothes as drab and nondescript as those he had packed, put on his wristwatch, pocketed his other belongings, and picked up his suitcase and went down the stairs. The front door was open. He could see his two guards talking to the driver of a battered Ziss saloon. "Bloody fools," he thought. He still did most of his thinking in English. "Probably telling him to see I get on the plane all right. Probably can't imagine that a foreigner would want to live in their blasted country." The cold eyes sneered as Grant put down his suitcase on the doorstep and hunted among the bunch of coats that hung from pegs on the kitchen door. He found his uniform, the drab raincoat and black cloth cap of Soviet officialdom, put them on, picked up his suitcase, and went out and clambered in beside the plainclothes driver, roughly shouldering aside one of the guards as he did so. The two men stood back, saying nothing, but looking at him with hard eyes. The driver took his foot off the clutch, and the car, already in gear, accelerated fast away down the dusty road. The villa was on the southeastern coast of the Crimea, about halfway between Feodosia and Yalta. It was one of many official holiday dachas along the favourite stretch of mountainous coastline that is part of the Russian Riviera. Red Grant knew that he was immensely privileged to be housed there, instead of in some dreary villa on the outskirts of Moscow. As the car climbed up into the mountains, he thought that they certainly treated him as well as they knew how, even if their concern for his welfare had two faces. The 40-mile drive to the airport at Simferopol took an hour. There were no other cars on the road, and the occasional cart from the vineyards quickly pulled into the ditch at the sound of their horn. As everywhere in Russia, a car meant an official, and an official could only mean danger. There were roses all the way, fields of them alternating with the vineyards, hedges of them along the road, and at the approach to the airport, a vast circular bed planted with red and white varieties to make a red star against a white background. Grant was sick of them, and he longed to get to Moscow and away from their sweet stench. They drove past the entrance to the civil airport, and followed a high wall for about a mile to the military side of the aerodrome. At a tall wire gate, the driver showed his pass to two Tommy-gunned sentries and drove through onto the tarmac. Several planes stood about, big camouflaged military transports, small twin-engine trainers, and two Navy helicopters. The driver stopped to ask a man in overalls where to find Grant's plane. At once a metallic twanging came from the observant control tower, and a loudspeaker barked at them, "To the left, far down to the left, number VBO. The driver was obediently motoring on across the tarmac when the iron voice barked again, "Stop!" As the driver jammed on his brakes, there sounded a deafening scream above their heads. Both men instinctively ducked as a flight of four MiG-17s came out of the setting sun and skimmed over them, their squat windbrakes right down for the landing. The planes hit the huge runway one after the other, puffs of blue smoke spurting from their nose tires, and, with jets howling, taxied to the distant boundary line and turned to come back to the control tower and the hangars.
"Proceed."
100 yards farther on, they came to a plane with the recognition letters VBO. It was a two-engined Ilyushin 12. A small aluminium ladder hung down from the cabin door, and the car stopped beside it. One of the crew appeared at the door. He came down the ladder and carefully examined the driver's pass and Grant's identity papers, and then waved the driver away and gestured Grant to follow him up the ladder. He didn't offer to help him with a suitcase, but Grant carried it up the ladder as if it had been no heavier than a book. The crewman pulled the ladder up after him, banged the wide hatch shut, and went forward to the cockpit. There were 20 empty seats to choose from. Grant settled into the one nearest the hatch and fastened his seat belt. A short crackle of talk with the control tower came through the open door to the cockpit. The two engines whined and coughed and fired, and the plane turned quickly, as if it had been a motor car, rolled out to the start of the north-south runway, and, without any further preliminaries, hurtled down it and up into the air. Grant unbuckled his seatbelt, lit a gold-tipped Troika cigarette, and settled back to reflect comfortably on his past career and to consider the immediate future. Donovan Grant was the result of a midnight union between a German professional weightlifter and a Southern Irish waitress. The union lasted for a quarter of an hour on the damp grass behind a circus tent outside Belfast. Afterwards, the father gave the mother half a crown, and the mother walked happily home to her bed in the kitchen of a café near the railway station. When the baby was expected, she went to live with an aunt in the small village of Ochmacloy that straddles the border. And there, 6 months later, she died of puerperal fever shortly after giving birth to a 12-pound boy. Before she died, she said that the boy was to be called Donovan. The weightlifter had styled himself the Mighty O'Donovan, and Grant, which was her own name. The boy was reluctantly cared for by the aunt and grew up healthy and extremely strong, but very quiet. He had no friends. He refused to communicate with other children, and when he wanted anything from them, he took it with his fists. In the local school he continued to be feared and disliked, but he made a name for himself boxing and wrestling at local fairs, where the bloodthirsty fury of his attack, combined with guile, gave him the victory over much older and bigger boys. It was through his fighting that he came to the notice of the Sinn Feiners, who used Ochmacloy as a principal pipeline for their comings and goings with the North, and also of the local smugglers who used the village for the same purpose. When he left school, he became a strong-arm man for both these groups. They paid him well for his work, but saw as little of him as they could. It was about this time that his body began to feel strange and violent compulsions around the time of the full moon, when, in October of his 16th year, he first got the feelings, as he called them to himself, he went out and strangled a cat. This made him feel better for a whole month. In November it was a big sheepdog, and for Christmas he slit the throat of a cow at midnight in a neighbour's shed. These actions made him feel good. He had enough sense to see that the village would soon start wondering about the mysterious deaths, so he bought a bicycle, and on one night every month he rode off into the countryside. Often he had to go very far to find what he wanted, and after 2 months of having to satisfy himself with geese and chickens, he took a chance and cut the throat of a sleeping tramp. There were so few people abroad at night that soon he took to the roads earlier, bicycling far and wide so that he came to distant villages in the dusk, when solitary people were coming home from the fields and girls were going out to their trysts. When he killed the occasional girl, he did not interfere with her in any way. That side of things, which he had heard talked about, was quite incomprehensible to him. It was only the wonderful act of killing that made him feel better, nothing else. By the end of his 17th year, ghastly rumours were spreading round the whole of Fermanagh, Tyrone and Armagh. When a woman was killed in broad daylight, strangled and thrust carelessly into a haystack, the rumours flared into panic. Groups of vigilantes were formed in the villages, police reinforcements were brought in with police dogs, and stories about the moon killer brought journalists to the area. Several times Grant, on his bicycle, was stopped and questioned, but he had powerful protection in Ochmacloy, and his story of training spins to keep him fit for his boxing were always backed up, for he was now the pride of the village and contender for the North of Ireland light heavyweight championship. Again, before it was too late, instinct saved him from discovery, and he left Ochmacloy and went to Belfast and put himself in the hands of a broken-down boxing promoter who wanted him to turn professional. Discipline in the sleazy gymnasium was strict. It was almost a prison. And when the blood first boiled again in Grant's veins, there was nothing for it but to half-kill one of his sparring partners. After twice having to be pulled off a man in the ring, it was only by winning the championship that he was saved from being thrown out by the promoter. Grant won the championship in 1945, on his 18th birthday. Then they took him for national service, and he became a driver in the Royal Corps of Signals. The training period in England sobered him, or at least made him more careful when he had the feelings. Now, at the full moon, he took to drink instead. He would take a bottle of whisky into the woods round Aldershot and drink it all down as he watched his sensations, coldly, until unconsciousness came. Then, in the early hours of the morning, he would stagger back to camp, only half satisfied, but not dangerous any more. If a sentry caught him, it was only a day's CB, because his commanding officer wanted to keep him happy for the army championships. But Grant's transport section was rushed to Berlin about the time of the corridor trouble with the Russians, and he missed the championships. In Berlin, the constant smell of danger intrigued him and made him even more careful and cunning. He still got dead drunk at the full moon, but all the rest of the time he was watching and plotting. He liked all he heard about the Russians, their brutality, their carelessness of human life, and their guile. And he decided to go over to them. But how? What could he bring them as a gift? What did they want? It was the BAOR championships that finally told him to go over. By chance, they took place on a night of the full moon. Grant, fighting for the Royal Corps, was warned for holding and hitting low, and was disqualified in the third round for persistent foul fighting. The whole stadium hissed him as he left the ring. The loudest demonstration came from his own regiment, and the next morning the commanding officer sent for him and coldly said he was a disgrace to the Royal Corps and would be sent home with the next draft. His fellow drivers sent him to Coventry, and since no one would drive transport with him, he had to be transferred to the coveted motorcycle dispatch service. The transfer could not have suited Grant better. He waited a few days, and then, one evening when he had collected the day's outgoing mail from the military intelligence headquarters on the Reichskanzlerplatz, he made straight for the Russian sector, waited with his engine running until the British control gate was opened to allow a taxi through, and then tore through the closing gate at 40 and skidded to a stop beside the concrete pillbox of the Russian frontier post. They hauled him roughly into the guardroom. A wooden-faced officer behind a desk asked him what he wanted.
"I want the Soviet Secret Service," said Grant flatly, "the head of it."
The officer stared coldly at him. He said something in Russian. The soldiers who had brought Grant in started to drag him out again. Grant easily shook them off. One of them lifted his Tommy gun. Grant said, speaking patiently and distinctly,
"I have a lot of secret papers. Outside. In the leather bags on the motorcycle."
He had a brainwave.
"You will get into bad trouble if they don't get your Secret Service."
The officer said something to the soldiers, and they stood back.
"We have no secret service," he said in stilted English. "Sit down and complete this form."
Grant sat down at the desk and filled in a long form which asked questions about anyone who wanted to visit the Eastern Zone. Name, address, nature of business, and so forth. Meanwhile, the officer spoke softly and briefly into a telephone. By the time Grant had finished, two more soldiers, non-commissioned officers wearing drab green forage caps and with green badges of rank on their khaki uniforms, had come into the room. The frontier officer handed the form, without looking at it, to one of them, and they took Grant out and put him and his motorcycle into the back of a closed van and locked the door on him. After a fast drive lasting a quarter of an hour, the van stopped, and when Grant got out he found himself in the courtyard, behind a large new building. He was taken into the building and up in a lift, and left alone in a cell without windows. It contained nothing but one iron bench. After an hour, during which, he supposed, they went through the secret papers, he was led into a comfortable office in which an officer, with three rows of decorations and the gold tabs of a full colonel, was sitting behind a desk. The desk was bare, except for a bowl of roses. 10 years later, Grant, looking out of the window of the plane at a wide cluster of lights 20,000 feet below, which he guessed was Kharkov, grinned mirthlessly at his reflection in the Perspex window. Roses. From that moment his life had been nothing but roses. Roses, roses, all the way. Chapter 3. Postgraduate Studies.
"So, you would like to work in the Soviet Union, Mr. Grant?"
It was half an hour later, and the MGB colonel was bored with the interview. He thought that he had extracted from this rather unpleasant British soldier every military detail that could possibly be of interest. A few polite phrases to repay the man for the rich haul of secrets his dispatch bags had yielded, and then the man could go down to the cells and in due course be shipped off to Vorkuta or some other labour camp.
"Yes, I would like to work for you."
"And what work could you do, Mr. Grant? We have plenty of unskilled labour. We do not need truck drivers, and—"
The colonel smiled fleetingly.
"If there is any boxing to be done, we have plenty of men who can box. Two possible Olympic champions amongst them, incidentally."
"I am an expert at killing people. I do it very well. I like it."
The colonel saw the red flame that flickered for an instant behind the very pale blue eyes under the sandy lashes. He thought the man means it. He's mad as well as unpleasant. He looked coldly at Grant, wondering if it was worthwhile wasting food on him at Vorkuta. Better perhaps have him shot, or throw him back into the British sector and let his own people worry about him.
"You don't believe me,"
said Grant impatiently. This was the wrong man, the wrong department. "Who does the rough stuff for you here?" He was certain the Russians had some sort of a murder squad. Everybody said so.
"Let me talk to them. I'll kill somebody for them. Anybody they like. Now."
The colonel looked at him sourly. Perhaps he had better report the matter.
"Wait here."
He got up and went out of the room, leaving the door open. A guard came and stood in the doorway and watched Grant's back, his hand on his pistol. The colonel went into the next room. It was empty. There were three telephones on the desk. He picked up the receiver of the MGB direct line to Moscow. When the military operator answered, he said, "Smirsch." When Smirsch answered, he asked for the chief of operations. 10 minutes later, he put the receiver back. What luck! A simple, constructive solution. Whichever way it went, it would turn out well. If the Englishman succeeded, it would be splendid. If he failed, it would still cause a lot of trouble in the Western sector. Trouble for the British, because Grant was their man. Trouble with the Germans, because the attempt would frighten a lot of their spies. Trouble with the Americans, because they were supplying most of the funds for the Baumgarten ring, and would now think Baumgarten's security was no good. Pleased with himself, the colonel walked back into his office and sat down again opposite Grant.
"You mean what you say?"
"Of course I do."
"Have you a good memory?"
"Yes."
"In the British sector, there is a German called Dr. Baumgarten. He lives in flat 5, at number 22 Kfürstendamm. Do you know where that is?"
"Yes."
"Tonight, with your motorcycle, you will be put back into the British sector. Your number plates will be changed. Your people will be on the lookout for you. You will take an envelope to Dr. Baumgarten. It will be marked to be delivered by hand. In your uniform, and with this envelope, you will have no difficulty. You will say that the message is so private that you must see Dr. Baumgarten alone. Then you will kill him."
The colonel paused. His eyebrows lifted.
"Yes?"
"Yes," said Grant stolidly. "And if I do, will you give me more of this work?"
"It is possible," said the colonel indifferently. "First you must show what you can do. When you have completed your task and returned to the Soviet sector, you may ask for Colonel Boris."
He rang a bell, and a man in plain clothes came in. The colonel gestured towards him.
"This man will give you food. Later he will give you the envelope and a sharp knife of American manufacture. It is an excellent weapon. Good luck."
The colonel reached and picked a rose out of the bowl and sniffed it luxuriously. Grant got to his feet.
"Thank you, sir," he said warmly.
The colonel did not answer or look up from the rose. Grant followed the man in plain clothes out of the room. The plane roared on across the heartland of Russia. They had left behind them the blast furnaces flaming far away to the east around Stalino, and to the west the silver thread of the Dnieper branching away at Dnipropetrovsk. The splash of light around Kharkov had marked the frontier of the Ukraine, and the smaller blaze of the phosphate town of Kursk had come and gone. Now Grant knew that the solid, unbroken blackness below hid the great central steppe, where the billions of tons of Russia's grain were whispering and ripening in the darkness. There would be no more oases of light until, in another hour, they would have covered the last 300 miles to Moscow. For by now Grant knew a lot about Russia. After the quick, neat, sensational murder of a vital West German spy, Grant had no sooner slipped back over the frontier and somehow fumbled his way to Colonel Boris than he was put into plain clothes with a flying helmet to cover his hair, hustled into an empty MGB plane and flown straight to Moscow. Then began a year of semi-prison, which Grant had devoted to keeping fit and to learning Russian while people came and went around him, interrogators, stool pigeons, doctors. Meanwhile, Soviet spies in England and Northern Ireland had painstakingly investigated his past. At the end of the year, Grant was given as clean a bill of political health as any foreigner can get in Russia. The spies had confirmed his story. The English and American stool pigeons reported that he was totally uninterested in the politics or social customs of any country in the world, and the doctors and psychologists agreed that he was an advanced manic depressive whose periods coincided with the full moon. They added that Grant was also a narcissist and asexual, and that his tolerance of pain was high. These peculiarities apart, his physical health was superb, and, though his educational standards were hopelessly low, he was as naturally cunning as a fox. Everyone agreed that Grant was an exceedingly dangerous member of society, and that he should be put away. When the dossier came before the head of personnel of the MGB, he was about to write "kill him" in the margin, when he had second thoughts. A great deal of killing has to be done in the USSR, not because the average Russian is a cruel man, although some of their races are among the cruelest peoples in the world, but as an instrument of policy. People who act against the state are enemies of the state, and the state has no room for enemies. There is too much to do for precious time to be allotted to them, and if they are a persistent nuisance, they get killed. In a country with a population of 200 million, you can kill many thousands a year without missing them. If, as happened in the two biggest purges, 1 million people have to be killed in 1 year, that is also not a grave loss. The serious problem is the shortage of executioners. Executioners have a short life. They get tired of the work. The soul sickens of it. After 10, 20, 100 death rattles, the human being, however subhuman he may be, acquires, perhaps by a process of osmosis with death itself, a germ of death which enters his body and eats into him like a canker. Melancholy and drink take him, and a dreadful lassitude which brings a glaze to the eyes and slows up the movements and destroys accuracy. When the employer sees these signs, he has no alternative but to execute the executioner and find another one. The head of personnel of the MGB was aware of the problem, and of the constant search not only for the refined assassin, but also for the common butcher. And here at last was a man who appeared to be expert at both forms of killing, dedicated to his craft, and indeed, if the doctors were to be believed, destined for it. Head of personnel wrote a short, pungent minute on Grant's papers, marked them Smirsch Otdiel 2, and tossed them into his out-tray. Department 2 of Smirsch, in charge of operations and executions, took over the body of Donovan Grant, changed his name to Granitsky, and put him on their books. The next 2 years were hard for Grant. He had to go back to school, and to a school that made him long for the chipped deal desks in the corrugated iron shed full of the smell of little boys and the hum of drowsy blue bottles. That had been his only conception of what a school was like. Now, in the intelligence school for foreigners outside Leningrad, squashed tightly among the ranks of Germans, Czechs, Poles, Balts, Chinese and Negroes, all with serious, dedicated faces and pens that raced across their notebooks, he struggled with subjects that were pure double Dutch to him. There were courses in general political knowledge, which included the history of labour movements, of the Communist Party and the industrial forces of the world, and the teachings of Marx, Lenin and Stalin, all dotted with foreign names which he could barely spell. There were lessons on the class enemy we are fighting, with lectures on capitalism and fascism, weeks spent on tactics, agitation and propaganda, and more weeks on the problems of minority peoples, colonial races, the Negroes, the Jews. Every month ended with examinations during which Grant sat and wrote illiterate nonsense, interspersed with scraps of half-forgotten English history and misspelled communist slogans, and inevitably had his papers torn up, on one occasion in front of the whole class. But he stuck it out, and when they came to technical subjects, he did better. He was quick to understand the rudiments of codes and ciphers, because he wanted to understand them. He was good at communications, and immediately grasped the maze of contacts, cutouts, couriers, and post-boxes, and he got excellent marks for fieldwork, in which each student had to plan and operate dummy assignments in the suburbs and countryside around Leningrad. Finally, when it came to tests of vigilance, discretion, safety first, presence of mind, courage and coolness, he got top marks out of the whole school. At the end of the year, The report that went back to Smersh concluded, political value, nil. Operational value, excellent. Which was just what Otdiel too wanted to hear. The next year was spent, with only two other foreign students among several hundred Russians, at the School for Terror and Diversion at Kuchino, outside Moscow. Here Grant went triumphantly through courses in judo, boxing, athletics, photography, and radio, under the general supervision of the famous Colonel Arkady Fotoyev, father of the modern Soviet spy, and completed his small arms instruction at the hands of Lieutenant Colonel Nikolai Godlovsky, the Soviet rifle champion. Twice during this year, without warning, an MGB car came for him on the night of the full moon and took him to one of the Moscow jails. There, with a black hood over his head, he was allowed to carry out executions with various weapons, the rope, the axe, the submachine gun. Electrocardiograms, blood pressure, and various other medical tests were applied to him before, during, and after these occasions, but their purpose and findings were not revealed to him. It was a good year, and he felt, and rightly, that he was giving satisfaction. In 1949 and 50, Grant was allowed to go on minor operations with mobile groups, or avanposts, in the satellite countries. These were beatings up and simple assassinations of Russian spies and intelligence workers suspected of treachery or other aberrations. Grant carried out these duties neatly, exactly, and inconspicuously, and though he was carefully and constantly watched, he never showed the smallest deviation from the standards required of him, and no weaknesses of character or technical skill. It might have been different if he had been required to kill when doing a solo task at the full moon period, but his superiors, realizing that at that period he would be outside their control, or his own, chose safe dates for his operations. The moon period was reserved exclusively for butchery in the prisons, and from time to time this was arranged for him as a reward for a successful operation in cold blood. In 1951 and 52, Grant's usefulness became more fully and more officially recognized. As a result of excellent work, notably in the eastern sector of Berlin, he was granted Soviet citizenship and increases in pay, which by 1953 amounted to a handsome 5,000 rubles a month. In 1953 he was given the rank of major, with pension rights backdated to the day of his first contact with Colonel Boris, and the villa in the Crimea was allotted to him. Two bodyguards were attached to him, partly to protect him and partly to guard against the outside chance of his going private, as defection is called in MGB jargon, and once a month he was transported to the nearest jail and allowed as many executions as there were candidates available. Naturally, Grant had no friends. He was hated, or feared, or envied by everyone who came in contact with him. He did not even have any of those professional acquaintanceships that pass for friendship in the discreet and careful world of Soviet officialdom. But if he noticed the fact, he didn't care. The only individuals he was interested in were his victims. The rest of his life was inside him, and it was richly and excitingly populated with his thoughts. Then, of course, he had Smersh. No one in the Soviet Union who has Smersh on his side need worry about friends, or indeed about anything whatever except keeping the black wings of Smersh over his head. Grant was still thinking vaguely of how he stood with his employers when the plane started to lose altitude as it picked up the radar beam of Tushino Airport just south of the red glow that was Moscow. He was at the top of his tree, the chief executioner of Smersh, and therefore of the whole of the Soviet Union. What could he aim for now? Further promotion? More money? More gold knick-knacks? More important targets? Better techniques? There really didn't seem to be anything more to go for. Or was there perhaps some other man whom he had never heard of, in some other country, who would have to be set aside before absolute supremacy was his? Chapter 4. The Moguls of Death. Smersh is the official murder organization of the Soviet government. It operates both at home and abroad, and in 1955 it employed a total of 40,000 men and women. Smersh is a contraction of Smert Spionam, which means death to spies. It is a name used only among its staff and among Soviet officials. No sane member of the public would dream of allowing the word to pass his lips. The headquarters of SMERSH is a very large and ugly modern building on the Sretenko Ulitsa. It is number 13 on this wide, dull street, and pedestrians keep their eyes to the ground as they pass the two sentries with submachine guns who stand on either side of the broad steps leading up to the big iron double door. If they remember in time, or can do so inconspicuously, they cross the street and pass by on the other side. The direction of SMERSH is carried out from the second floor. The most important room on the second floor is a very large, light room, painted in the pale olive green that is the common denominator of government offices all over the world. Opposite the soundproofed door, two wide windows look over the courtyard at the back of the building. The floor is close-fitted, with a colourful Caucasian carpet of the finest quality. Across the far left-hand corner of the room stands a massive oak desk. The top of the desk is covered with red velvet under a thick sheet of plate glass. On the left side of the desk are in and out baskets, and on the right four telephones. From the centre of the desk, to form a T with it, a conference table stretches diagonally out across the room. Eight straight-backed red leather chairs are drawn up to it. This table is also covered with red velvet, but without protective glass. Ashtrays are on the table, and two heavy carafes of water with glasses. On the walls are four large pictures in gold frames. In 1955 these were a portrait of Stalin over the door, one of Lenin between the two windows, and facing each other on the other two walls, portraits of Bulganin, and, where until January of the 13th, 1954, a portrait of Beria had hung, a portrait of Army General Ivan Alexandrovich Serov, chief of the Committee of State Security. On the left-hand wall, under the portrait of Bulganin, stands a large televisor, or TV set, in a handsome, polished oak cabinet. Concealed in this is a tape recorder which can be switched on from the desk. The microphone for the recorder stretches under the whole area of the conference table, and its leads are concealed in the legs of the table. Next to the televisor is a small door leading into a personal lavatory and washroom and into a small projection room for showing secret films. Under the portrait of General Serov is a bookcase containing, on the top shelves, the works of Marx, Engels, Lenin, and Stalin, and, more accessibly, books in all languages on espionage, counter-espionage, police methods, and criminology. Next to the bookcase, against the wall, stands a long, narrow table on which are a dozen large leather-bound albums with dates stamped in gold on the covers. These contain photographs of Soviet citizens and foreigners who have been assassinated by SMERSH. About the time Grant was coming into land at Toshino Airport, just before 11:30 at night, a tough-looking, thick-set man of about 50 was standing at this table, leafing through the volume for 1954. The head of SMERSH, Colonel General Grubozoboyshikov, known in the building as G, was dressed in a neat khaki tunic with a high collar and dark blue cavalry trousers with two thin red stripes down the sides. The trousers ended in riding boots of soft, highly polished black leather. On the breast of the tunic were three rows of medal ribbons, two orders of Lenin, Order of Suvorov, Order of Alexander Nevsky, Order of the Red Banner, two orders of the Red Star, the 20 years' service medal, and medals for the defence of Moscow and the capture of Berlin. At the tail of these came the rose, pink, and grey ribbon of the British CBE, and the claret and white ribbon of the American Medal for Merit. Above the ribbons hung the gold star of a hero of the Soviet Union. Above the high collar of the tunic the face was narrow and sharp. There were flabby pouches under the eyes, which were round and brown, and protruded like polished marbles below thick black brows. The skull was shaven clean, and the tight white skin glittered in the light of the central chandelier. The mouth was broad and grim above a deeply cleft chin. It was a hard, unyielding face of formidable authority. One of the telephones on the desk buzzed softly. The man walked with tight and precise steps to his tall chair behind the desk. He sat down and picked up the receiver of the telephone, marked in white with the letters VCH. These letters are short for Vysokaya Chastota, or high frequency. Only some 50 supreme officials are connected to the VCH switchboard, and all are ministers of state or heads of selected departments. It is served by a small exchange in the Kremlin operated by professional security officers. Even they cannot overhear conversations on it, but every word spoken over its lines is automatically recorded.
Yes? Serov speaking. What action has been taken since the meeting of the Presidium this morning? I have a meeting here in a few minutes' time, Comrade General. Rumid, GRU, and of course MGB. After that, if action is agreed, I shall have a meeting with my head of operations and head of plans. In case liquidation is decided upon, I have taken the precaution of bringing the necessary operative to Moscow. This time I shall myself supervise the preparations. We do not want another Khoklov affair.
The devil knows we don't. Telephone me after the first meeting. I wish to report to the Presidium tomorrow morning.
Certainly, Comrade General.
General G put back the receiver and pressed a bell under his desk. At the same time, he switched on the wire recorder. His ADC, an MGB captain, came in.
Have they arrived?
Yes, Comrade General.
Bring them in.
In a few minutes, six men, five of them in uniform, filed in through the door, and with hardly a glance at the man behind the desk, took their places at the conference table. They were three senior officers, heads of their departments, and each was accompanied by an ADC. In the Soviet Union, no man goes alone to a conference. For his own protection and for the reassurance of his department, he invariably takes a witness so that his department can have independent versions of what went on at the conference, and, above all, of what was said on its behalf. This is important in case there is a subsequent investigation. No notes are taken at the conference, and decisions are passed back to departments by word of mouth. On the far side of the table sat Lieutenant General Slavin, head of the GRU, the intelligence department of the general staff of the army, with a full colonel beside him. At the end of the table sat Lieutenant General Vozdvizhensky of Rumid, the intelligence department of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, with a middle-aged man in plain clothes. With his back to the door sat Colonel of State Security Nikitin, head of intelligence for the MGB, the Soviet Secret Service, with a major at his side.
"Good evening, comrades."
A polite, careful murmur came from the three senior officers. Each one knew, and thought he was the only one to know, that the room was wired for sound, and each one, without telling his ADC, had decided to utter the bare minimum of words consonant with good discipline and the needs of the state.
"Let us smoke."
General G took out a packet of Moskva Volga cigarettes and lit one with an American Zippo lighter. There was a clicking of lighters round the table. General G pinched the long cardboard tube of his cigarette so that it was almost flat, and put it between his teeth on the right side of his mouth. He stretched his lips back from his teeth and started talking in short, clipped sentences that came out with something of a hiss from between the teeth and the up-tilted cigarette.
"Comrades, we meet under instructions from Comrade General Serov. General Serov, on behalf of the Presidium, has ordered me to make known to you certain matters of state policy. We are then to confer and recommend a course of action which will be in line with this policy and assist it. We have to reach our decision quickly, but our decision will be of supreme importance to the state. It will therefore have to be a correct decision."
General G paused to allow the significance of his words time to sink in. One by one, he slowly examined the faces of the three senior officers at the table. Their eyes looked stolidly back at him. Inside, these extremely important men were perturbed. They were about to look through the furnace door. They were about to learn a state secret, the knowledge of which might one day have most dangerous consequences for them. Sitting in the quiet room, they felt bathed in the dreadful incandescence that shines out from the center of all power in the Soviet Union, the High Presidium. The final ash fell off the end of General G's cigarette onto his tunic. He brushed it off and threw the cardboard butt into the basket for secret waste behind his desk. He lit another cigarette and spoke through it.
"Our recommendation concerns a conspicuous act of terrorism to be carried out in enemy territory within 3 months."
Six pairs of expressionless eyes stared at the head of Smersh, waiting.
"Comrades,
General G leant back in his chair, and his voice became expository. "The foreign policy of the USSR has entered a new phase. Formerly it was a hard policy, a policy," he allowed himself the joke of Stalin's name, "of steel. This policy, effective as it was, built up tensions in the West, notably in America, which were becoming dangerous. The Americans are unpredictable people. They are hysterical. The reports of our intelligence began to indicate that we were pushing America to the brink of an undeclared atomic attack on the USSR. You have read these reports, and you know what I say is true. We do not want such a war. If there is to be a war, it is we who will choose the time. Certain powerful Americans, notably the Pentagon Group led by Admiral Radford, were helped in their firebrand schemes by the very successes of our hard policy. So it was decided that the time had come to change our methods while maintaining our aims. A new policy was created, the hard-soft policy. Geneva was the beginning of this policy. We were soft. China threatens Quemoy and Matsu. We are hard. We open our frontiers to a lot of newspapermen and actors and artists, although we know many of them to be spies. Our leaders laugh and make jokes at receptions in Moscow. In the middle of the jokes, we drop the biggest test bomb of all time. Comrades Bulganin and Khrushchev and Comrade General Serov, General G carefully included the names for the ears of the tape recorder, visit India and the East and blackguard the English. When they get back, they have friendly discussions with the British ambassador about their forthcoming goodwill visit to London. And so it goes on. The stick, and then the carrot. The smile, and then the frown. And the West is confused. Tensions are relaxed before they have time to harden. The reactions of our enemies are clumsy, their strategy disorganized. Meanwhile, the common people laugh at our jokes, cheer our football teams, and slobber with delight when we release a few prisoners of war whom we wish to feed no longer. There were smiles of pleasure and pride round the table. What a brilliant policy! What fools we are making of them in the West! At the same time, continued General G, himself smiling thinly at the pleasure he had caused, we continue to forge everywhere stealthily ahead. Revolution in Morocco, arms to Egypt, friendship with Yugoslavia, trouble in Cyprus, riots in Turkey, strikes in England, great political gains in France. There is no front in the world on which we are not quietly advancing. General G saw the eyes shining greedily round the table. The men were softened up. Now it was time to be hard. Now it was time for them to feel the new policy on themselves. The intelligence services would also have to pull their weight in this great game that was being played on their behalf. Smoothly, General G leaned forward. He planted his right elbow on the desk and raised his fist in the air. "But, comrades," his voice was soft, "where has there been failure in carrying out the state policy of the USSR? Who has all along been soft when we wished to be hard? Who has suffered defeats while victory was going to all other departments of the state? Who, with its stupid blunders, has made the Soviet Union look foolish and weak throughout the world? Who?" The voice had risen almost to a scream. General G thought how well he was delivering the denunciation demanded by the Presidium, how splendid it would sound when the tape was played back to Serov. He glared down the conference table at the pale, expectant faces. General G's fist crashed forward onto the desk. "The whole intelligence apparatus of the Soviet Union, comrades!" The voice was now a furious bellow. "It is we who are the sluggards, the saboteurs, the traitors. It is we who are failing the Soviet Union in its great and glorious struggle. We!" His arm swept around the room. "All of us!" The voice came back to normal, became more reasonable. "Comrades, look at the record. Sukhansin, he allowed himself the peasant obscenity, "son of a bitch. Look at the record. First we lose Kuzenko and the whole of the Canadian apparat, and the scientist Fuchs. Then the American apparat is cleaned up. Then we lose men like Tokayev. Then comes the scandalous Kochlov affair, which did great damage to our country. Then Petrov and his wife in Australia, a bungled business if ever there was one. The list is endless, defeat after defeat, and the devil knows I have not mentioned the half of it." General G. paused. He continued in his softest voice, "Comrades, I have to tell you that unless tonight we make a recommendation for a great intelligence victory, and unless we act correctly on that recommendation, if it is approved, there will be trouble." General G. sought for a final phrase to convey the threat without defining it. He found it. "There will be." He paused and looked, with artificial mildness, down the table. "Displeasure." Chapter 5. Conspiratia. The Mujiks had received the knout. General G. gave them a few minutes to lick their wounds and recover from the shock of the official lashing that had been meted out. No one said a word for the defense. No one spoke up for his department or mentioned the countless victories of Soviet intelligence that could be set against the few mistakes. And no one questioned the right of the head of SMERSH, who shared the guilt with them, to deliver this terrible denunciation. The word had gone out from the throne, and General G. had been chosen as the mouthpiece for the word. It was a great compliment to General G. that he had been thus chosen, a sign of grace, a sign of coming preferment, and everyone present made a careful note of the fact that, in the intelligence hierarchy, General G., with SMERSH behind him, had come to the top of the pile. At the end of the table, the representative of the Foreign Ministry, Lieutenant General Vozdvizhensky of Rumid, watched the smoke curl up from the tip of his long Kazbek cigarette, and remembered how Molotov had privately told him, when Beria was dead, that General G. would go far. There had been no great foresight in this prophecy, reflected Vozdvizhensky. Beria had disliked G., and had constantly hindered his advancement, sidetracking him away from the main ladder of power into one of the minor departments of the then Ministry of State Security, which, on the death of Stalin, Beria had quickly abolished as a ministry. Until 1952, G. had been deputy to one of the heads of this ministry. When the post was abolished, he devoted his energies to plotting the downfall of Beria, working under the secret orders of the formidable General Serov, whose record put him out of even Beria's reach. Serov, a hero of the Soviet Union and a veteran of the famous predecessors of the MGB, the Cheka, the Ogpu, the NKVD, and the MVD, was in every respect a bigger man than Beria. He had been directly behind the mass executions of the 1930s, when a million died. He had been metteur en scène of most of the great Moscow show trials. He had organized the bloody genocide in the Central Caucasus in February 1944, and it was he who had inspired the mass deportations from the Baltic states and the kidnapping of the German atom and other scientists who had given Russia her great technical leap forward after the war. And Beria and all his court had gone to the gallows, while General G. had been given SMERSH as his reward. As for Army General Ivan Serov, he, with Bulganin and Khrushchev, now ruled Russia. One day he might even stand on the peak, alone. But, guessed General Vozdvizhensky, glancing up the table at the gleaming billiard-ball skull, probably with General G. not far behind him. The skull lifted, and the hard, bulging brown eyes looked straight down the table into the eyes of General Vozdvizhensky. General Vozdvizhensky managed to look back calmly, and even with a hint of appraisal. "That is a deep one," thought General G. "Let us put the spotlight on him and see how he shows up on the soundtrack."
"Comrades!"
Gold flashed from both corners of his mouth as he stretched his lips in a chairman's smile.
"Let us not be too dismayed. Even the highest tree has an axe waiting at its foot. We have never thought that our departments were so successful as to be beyond criticism. What I have been instructed to say to you will not have come as a surprise to any of us.
so let us take up the challenge with a good heart and get down to business."
Round the table there was no answering smile to these platitudes. General G had not expected that there would be. He lit a cigarette and continued.
"I said that we have at once to recommend an act of terrorism in the intelligence field, and one of our departments, no doubt my own, will be called upon to carry out this act."
An inaudible sigh of relief went round the table. So at least SMERSH would be the responsible department. That was something.
"But the choice of a target will not be an easy matter, and our collective responsibility for the correct choice will be a heavy one."
Soft, hard. Hard, soft. The ball was now back with the conference.
"It is not just a question of blowing up a building or shooting a prime minister. Such bourgeois horseplay is not contemplated. Our operation must be delicate, refined, and aimed at the heart of the intelligence apparat of the West. It must do grave damage to the enemy apparat, hidden damage, which the public will hear perhaps nothing of, but which will be the secret talk of government circles. But it must also cause a public scandal so devastating that the world will lick its lips and sneer at the shame and stupidity of our enemies. Naturally, governments will know that it is a Soviet conspiratia. That is good. It will be a piece of hard policy. And the agents and spies of the West will know it too, and they will marvel at our cleverness, and they will tremble. Traitors and possible defectors will change their minds. Our own operatives will be stimulated. They will be encouraged to greater efforts by our display of strength and genius. But, of course, we shall deny any knowledge of the deed, whatever it may be. And it is desirable that the common people of the Soviet Union should remain in complete ignorance of our complicity."
This book is continued on Disc 2.